And now let's give a big welcome to Quinn C. from West Hollywood as our main speaker.
Hi everybody, my name's Quinn, I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here, gratefully sober. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to be of service to your group. And that thank you for wrangling me up here again. I came and spoke up here 6 years ago. I'm terrible with timelines, but
2014,
thank you. I will engrave that in my mind. It was lovely last time, and I expect it will be lovely tonight. I hope so for all of you. I want to thank my dear friend Christopher for joining me on the drive up here from Los Angeles. Christopher is one of the few people in my sober family who knew me before I got here. And I think back in 1990, if you told him that he would take a three-hour drive with me up the coast of California for any reason at all, he would have said, hell no, at that time. So you never know what's going to happen, and things change, and people change, and circumstances change, and I absolutely cannot imagine my life without you, so thank you for coming with me tonight. I'm nervous. I get nervous when I speak. I've been done this numerous times in my sobriety. It still gets me unnerved for some reason. I don't know why. I know you're all friendly people. I hope you're all friendly people. And every time I get up here, I feel like I have to poo, pee, or pass out. And it hasn't happened yet, but the night is still young, so let's see what happens. My sobriety date is March 30th, 1993. I'm 26 years sober, and at the end of the month on March 30th, I'll be celebrating 27. I know some people say, God willing, I will, you know, it's like, the higher power I've developed around here is completely willing for me to turn 27 years sober at the end of the month. Am I willing to do what we do around here to maintain that? And that's the kind of the thing. Also, just give you a little more of the demographics. My date of birth is February 19th, 1969. So I got sober about a month after my 24th birthday. And I look at people who are 24 today, and I reflect back on myself, and it's kind of like it's a little bit of a cognitive trip for me, because when I got here, I didn't feel like what I think most 24-year-olds look like. I was really just like emotionally torn up, physically torn up too. You really wasn't like, it wasn't to the point where I was really sort of tending to my you know, your sort of daily needs. You know, I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I work in a psychiatric hospital, and we talk about people doing their ADLs, their activities of daily living. And like, that was not a priority to me before I got here. Just like things like bathing and grooming and things like that. Just was kind of like, that wasn't, you know, getting loaded was the priority. And what's interesting about that fact also too, is I realize it's kind of cool. I've been in 12-step recovery over 50% of my life at this point, which is, it's just kind of a fun little factoid. I don't think it really has any bearing on anything. I think one could say like, well, there's no excuses, you know? It's like, well, there's never been any excuses. So it's my deal to come up here and tell my story. And hopefully, I love speaker meetings. Like back in LA, I prefer speaker meetings over participation meetings. It's just my thing. Part of it also too is like I spent the first 4 years of my sobriety in the Pacific group. I know a lot of people have a lot of things to say, whatever. It was the best thing that could have possibly happened to me, because I was a willful little 24-year-old with no self-discipline whatsoever. And to go into this very structured group and just kind of be herded around and taught like good habits in the program was good for me. And also too, it's a lot of speaker meetings there too. And part of the reason I like it is like when I'm sitting where you guys are sitting right now, I like to just sit here and go like, yeah, me too. And it's the identification from hearing you guys tell your stories that really keeps my butt firmly planted in one of these seats in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, okay, let's get down to brass tacks. Okay, so I was born in 1969 in a place called Corona, California, in the so-called Inland Empire in Southern California. I don't know why they call it an empire, but anyways, to a couple of very young, idealistic parents. And they just did what they did, and they tried the best that they could. And I don't even remember my parents actually being physically together, truth be told. But my mom took care of me, and I was just a weird kid from the gate. And you know, you hear things in the program, people talk about feeling different and feeling not a part of and all that kind of stuff. And I think if that's really sort of a inherent part of this thing that we have, I felt it right out the womb, because let me give you an example. I was one of those smart, precocious kids, you know, like I could start reading really early. Like my mom would give me like a like piece of like newspaper and I could read it out phonetically. Like I was just one of that kid, which is like, it's cool, but it set me apart from the other kids because I was a little too precocious for my own good. And most of the kids were into nursery rhymes. I mean, I dug that a little bit, but I was more into pop music. And just to kind of put it in context of the time, my dad had a Corvette with an 8-track tape player in it. And I knew how to put the Woodstock soundtrack in there and push the button so I could get Sly and the Family Stone to sing "I Wanna Take You Higher." And my mom had always had record albums. And when I was a little kid, like even like 2 years old, I knew how to get the record and put the one I want and put on the song I want. Which is funny because when I turned a year sober, I started a part of my sobriety that became a nightclub DJ for a big chunk of my sobriety. So you never know what's going to happen when you're two. It's going to parlay when you grow up. So, but there were records that like my mom had on like Carole King's Tapestry album, and I loved that and those songs. But she had this one album that I really loved, and it was the soundtrack to the movie Sweet Charity starring Shirley MacLaine. And I remember I put on side one, I think it was track 3, and I'm like 2-3 years old and I'm putting it on, and there was this song, maybe some of you have heard it before, and it goes, bum, 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 hey, big spender. And my little 2-year-old, you know. So it escalated. And I got a little older, and I think I must have gotten this from like a Warner Brothers cartoon, but my mom, you know, when she got out of the shower, she had to wrap a towel around her head, and so I started doing that, and I wrapped one around my waist, and I started singing Quanta Lagusta by Carmen Miranda. I don't know where I got that from. Weird kid. You're like, Quanta Lagusta. And then disco came in the 70s, you know, and I used to do this impersonation of Donna Summer singing Love to Love You Baby. Like, you know, and she moaned in that song. She's like, oh, love to love you, baby. Oh, and she's like, I'm like 7. I'm gay, by the way, just to get that off the line. In case there was any question in anybody's mind tonight. And it could make it even more apropos, when I was 7, my mom packed us up and she moved us to West Hollywood, California from Corona, which actually was a fantastic, I was talking to Christopher tonight over driving up here, and it was really a fantastic place to grow up in as a kid in the 70s. It was just a really fun, relaxed environment and everything, and it was good. But what also happened when we moved up there, because I was this smart kid, and my mom was just, she was a fantastic single mother, and she enrolled me in Catholic school because I was a smart kid, and she felt that the rigors of the curriculum in the parochial school would be more apt to my overacting mind than public school would. And so I went to Catholic school starting in 2nd grade near the job that she had at the time. And it was fine. I actually liked it, except the fact that I was never baptized. So more weirdness. Like, it just keeps getting weirder and weirder. If any of you have been to Catholic school, in 2nd grade, you know, is when they give you the catechism for the sacraments. So we started getting this education, and I'm part of it all too, and they're telling you all this stuff about this thing called original sin, and if you didn't get baptized, you still have original sin on your soul. And so I'm being told, you know, by default, I have this thing that if I got hit by a bus, I'm not going to heaven. But no one was really clear where the children went at that point anymore. I'm precocious, so I asked the question, am I going to purgatory? Am I going here? Because I'm learning all this stuff and I'm trying to figure it out. And no one could give me a clear answer. So I didn't know if I was 7 years old and unbaptized and got hit by a bus where I was going to go. So it was very confusing for me. So subsequent to that, I couldn't have confession. I couldn't have First Holy Communion. So it was all these things that these kids were getting around me, I was not able to partake in. And it was just very weird. And I just was like, I just kind of went along, but there was just, I kind of questioned all of it. And I remember one day in catechism class, Sister Frances Mary, she came to us and she said in class, if you pray to Jesus and he doesn't answer your prayer, pray to Mary, because that's Jesus's mommy. And he doesn't say no to his mommy. And my little 8-year-old mind went, this is a crock. I'm like, I'm like, this makes no sense to me at all. Like, I just couldn't, like, wrap my overactive mind around this. So, the takeaway from that I think is the important part in terms of, like, the context of my sobriety is, until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I believed that there was a power greater than myself. The thing, though, is I didn't feel I had access to it. I felt that I was denied access to this thing. And it's such a beautiful thing to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Obviously, this is not religion. And doing a fifth step is not a confession. But the fact that I actually get the opportunity to systematically look at the things that are vexing in me in my life and to have an opportunity to look at my part and find something constructive to do to remedy it during the fourth and fifth step and the 10-step process is absolutely amazing. The fact of the matter is I get to find a power greater than myself that I understand myself in my own terms and my own definition. Now, I've been telling this story for many, many years, and my sponsor, Don in Los Angeles, one year he finally said, you know what, you need to quit. Like, it sounds like you're really dogging the Catholic Church. And the truth of the matter is, I don't know if I've sort of quote unquote made peace with the church, but you know, you grow and you get sober and you look at things a different way. And I didn't realize things until I opened my eyes. And the fact of the matter is, like, the Catholic Church actually does have a lot of some of the same values I have and some of the same issues on social justice issues that I have. And you know, it's just, you never know until you get to this place and when that happens in your life. It's interesting. I have sort of fallen in love with going to Mexico City out for vacation. And it's interesting because every time I go to the Basilica of the Virgin of Guadalupe down there. And it's like, I'm still not Catholic, but I'm so moved by the demonstrations of faith of the people that go there. And I'll tell you, sort of the adaptability of my higher power in recovery here has been, sometimes it's been more comfortable for me to sort of conceptualize my HP as kind of like my mom rather than my dad. So that get that kind of flexibility around here. So I'll tell you though, it just gets more and more nebulous and cool as the longer I stay sober. So actually, that I used to hate when I was new. There was a lot of stuff I hated when people said when I was new, and now I understand that the longer I'm sober, the less I know. Like, what are you talking about? Like, why are you guys hanging around, you know? But I get it now. When I was new, I was like a little baby. Everything was very, very concrete, and I needed, like, very, like, defined rules and understanding of things. And now I'm kind of able to live in the world with a little more ambiguity about it. And it's fine, and that's actually pretty magnificent. So, but my mom met a man. And we moved to the San Fernando Valley. Someone understand. And it's all curtains from there. So what happened was I went to public school, heaven forbid, and I was a smart kid, so my mom had me skip a grade. So now I'm back in public school, but I'm also a year younger than my classmates, and I'm like, still more weirdness, still more difference. So I get to junior high school, which is awkward for everybody, but junior high school's, you know, when the teenage hormones start kicking in and I start seeing all the other boys chasing the little girls, and I want no part of that. I want to chase something else, and no one else is doing that. And I'm like, okay, so we're just doing this, and I'm kind of like in my pillow at night going, ugh. I get to high school. So I enrolled in a drama class in high school. I think I intuitively knew that's where I was going to find my people. Basically. Which wound up being homosexuals, alcoholics, and alcoholic homosexuals. So, if any of you are sort of familiar with the canon of American theater, our first assignment was we had to pick a partner and pick any scene of any play we wanted, like sky's the limit. And I picked the opening scene where I got to play George from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. So it's like my first scene I ever did was like an end of the rope, like middle-aged alcoholic who's like at his wit's end with his equally alcoholic wife screaming at each other. That was like, of anything I could have picked, I could have Hamlet, anything. No, that was where I went. So kind of portending what was gonna come. So there was this girl that came to our class. And she wasn't in the class, but just was really daring. Like, someone actually, okay, also let's mind you, during this whole time, I'm really towing the line. I am a teacher's pet, candy ass, mama's boy. Like, no rule, you know, violations of any kind. That's kind of like my thing. So this girl, she had the audacity to leave her class and come into our class, not being there. I was like, ooh, that's, so she's looked at me and she said, do you want to go back to my place? I was like, yeah. I never ditch class, because what happened if you get caught? Isn't that horrible? The people that laughed have ditched class before, huh? So we went back to her house and we talked about deep metaphysical teenage nonsense, and she said, "Do you want to get drunk?" Now, I'd had little sips of alcohol before, but I'd never gotten sloshed, you know what I mean? I've never gotten drunk. So she put this artist smock on me, which is weird. I think she thought it was going to get messy. So, and she gave me a shot glass, and she filled it half with vodka, half with 7-Up. She said, "Put your hand on the top, bang it on the carpet, and you'll feel the effervescence of the bubbles, and slick it back, and you won't taste it." And you don't taste it very, you don't taste it much at all, as a matter of fact. And I proceeded to have a lot of those. And we jumped back in the car, obviously drunk, and went back to school. And like her, I went to a lot of people's classes who I wasn't supposed to be in. And apparently there's some photographs somewhere of me biting the corners of tables and stuff. This is my first drunk. So we invited some people back to her house again. So there was this boy in that drama class, and he sat next to me in the desk, and this is the 1980s, and I pined over him, and he was like blonde with this like surfer kind of whoosh, like flock of seagulls hair that went over one eye, and wore B-52s t-shirts, and I was just like, and from all accounts, a confirmed heterosexual, and I just like sat next to him, and like I would pine again, just like, and I'm like, why do I have to sit next to this person? So he actually joined this party back over at this girl's house again. And we're all kind of getting drunk still. He starts playing piano. I remember it was very romantic. He was playing Open Arms by Journey on the piano. And I'm feeling, you know, disinhibited. And I sit on the piano bench next to him because I don't care because I'm drunk for the first time. It's like, I've never felt this way. And like the parting of the Red Sea, like everyone left the room, I don't know, it was like magic, and the music stopped, and his hand reached into the inside of my thigh, and he said, "Do you want to go in the den?" And I said, "Yes." So what this means, people, is that within about 3 hours' time, I ditched school for the first time, I got drunk for the first time, and I lost my virginity to the person that I had the biggest crush on in the world, and they approached me. It does not get any better than that. It does not. And I ask you, I feel like I want to preach up here, and I ask you people, you know, would you not want to do this for the rest of your life? This changed the trajectory of everything. And I knew, I was like, and that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to get loaded, I wanted to have sex, and I wanted to avoid a responsibility. That was like, that's like the plan. And I did it until the wheels fell off. I really did. I don't feel like my case is quote unquote different, but sometimes I wonder if my alcoholism was sort of on a bit of a fast track. Just because things really did happen very quick and very rapidly. It was only 5 years after that first drunk until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time, mind you, the first time. So what happened was I just stopped going to school. I started running away from home. Hollywood in the 80s was like kind of a fabulous yet horrific place for teenage runaways. I'm not going to get into too much detail, but if you've seen one of those cheesy documentaries or after school specials from like the 80s, like it kind of was really like that, with like a lot of people taking advantage of young people. But I was also seeking these types of adventures. I thought I was out there having fun, and I thought that I was all doing this in pursuit of me having fun and having freedom. My big three substances are alcohol, hallucinogenics, and amphetamines. Because once I got drunk for the first time and I found out there was this whole pharmacopoeia of substances I could try to alter my consciousness and control my emotions, I was like, let's try them all at least twice, because maybe the first time's not going to take. And I did. But I'm going to tell you, because this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know probably most of, if not probably most of the people in the room, assuming, did something other than alcohol, but I know there's also people here that just drank. And I respect the singleness of purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I just want to kind of tease it out a little bit, because, okay, so I could take a hit of acid, I'd fry and hallucinate for like 8 to 12 hours, and I'd be exhausted. I would need to take a break from that for a little bit. Maybe at least 24 hours before I did it again, you know? Speed? Oh, I'll get into that later, but anyways, you know. But even with a big speed jag, you know, I would after I've come off it, I need a breather. I need to just relax and just like do something other than be amped up the whole time. Alcohol is different in the effect produced by alcohol and the phenomenon it has on my body. So the thing is, once I start drinking, I cannot stop. If I have been up all night and I pass out, because passing out is kind of the goal for me. If it's not explicit, it's sort of implicit to pass out, because that's falling asleep is like good because I don't have to wake up to reality. I know people talk sometimes about having triggers. Oh, I can't hear that song. I can't go to that intersection. My trigger is waking up in the morning. I find life by this point. No, it's true, because right at this point, I find life on life's terms untenable. And alcohol does something that nothing else does. I drink and I feel perfect. Nothing like that has ever, and to this day, never has had that effect on me, that immediate effect. Nothing. And also too, like I passed out. If there is a warm, flat beer at the side of the bed, even with a cigarette butt in it, I'm gonna swig on it. And I'm gonna get a little bit of the hair of the dog, you know? That's who I am. And that happened to me rather quickly. And in the pursuit of me going down these roads, a lot of things happened to me that probably shouldn't have happened to someone as young as me. And not even as young, I mean any human being at any part of the lifespan. I had knives pulled off out to me. I had guns pointed in my head because of the precarious situations I was getting myself to. I was sexually assaulted with a knife held to my throat in the pursuit of me going and trying to have some fun. These were things. I contracted mononucleosis and just treated it like it was a cold. I mean, there was no real regard for my personal safety, and a lot of really horrible stuff happened. There's this song, it's the title track on Joni Mitchell's Blue album. And she says in there, she says, everybody's saying that hell is the hippest way to go. I don't really think so, but I'm gonna take a look around it though. I think I always had that little bit of that moral compass in the back of my head that I did not, I knew that this was not the right thing to do, but I like to tiptoe into the dark side. And alcohol helped me to do that. Truth be told, I still like to tiptoe into the dark side. I just do it sober and not as intensely anymore. So just disclaimer. What happened was, had three kind of relatively short-term psychiatric hospitalizations, which is interesting because I'm a licensed clinical social worker at a psychiatric hospital right now. It's different though. I will tell you that with the patients I work with, I see great utility and benefit of psychiatric medications. And I see that people who have been suffering from paranoia and auditory hallucinations, that with a good regimen, it can actually help to alleviate some of that suffering. That didn't work for me. I have alcoholism, and all these things they tried on me just didn't really have any effect, because that's not my problem. The truth be told, if you've been taking acid every other day and drinking the whole time, you're gonna present like a depressed psychotic person when you show up to the clinic. But it kind of dissipates when you start doing the right thing, you know what I mean? So. They gave me psychotropic medications and it had no demonstrative benefit on me whatsoever. So I'm going in and out, in and out, in and out. Somehow I'm able to kind of try to pull it together, go back to school. I wound up graduating high school with honors. I don't know how I figured I wound up doing that. And I got to university and I found my people immediately. And I found the people that weren't going to class and they were doing drugs and they were drinking all night long. And we found all the liquor stores that sold to underage people. And we just like, that was just sort of like, I just really couldn't stay on what would be considered sort of a productive track anymore. Like, you know, the siren song to drink was the strongest thing possible. And it got to the point in 1998, I'm 20 years old, and in West Hollywood, I found this people in this apartment. One of them was a retired cop. The other one was just someone who I'd probably never had a real job in their entire life. They managed the building, so they had no rent. And there just seemed to be this nonstop. I had a sofa I could crash on. And there was this nonstop flow of like generic brand hard liquor. And I don't know, there's this magical supply of benzodiazepines flying through all the time. And so I just stayed numb. And I'll tell you, I just like, by this time, what I was noticing was that even at this early stage of the game, relatively early stage of the game, what I did was I drank to quiet the noise in my head. At this point, it was having a more paradoxical effect, and it seemed to be amplifying the voice in my head at this point. It did a reverse turn on me. And so I'm making me feel more miserable and I can't catch it. And then one day I just took a bottle of those pills and a bottle of that liquor and I downed them. I couldn't tell you today if it was a genuine attempt to commit suicide, if it was a cry for help or just a stupid move on my part. What I do know is that I got sent to the local hospital, woke up in 5-point restraint, charcoal dripping down the side of my mouth because they pumped my stomach. They tried to 550-150 me, but I finagled my way out of that because I'm crafty sometimes, even in the depths of despair. What happened was my uncle, who lived in Palm Springs, he 12-stepped me. And he had 8 years of sobriety at the time. And he took me out there and he took me to what's now just called the ranch, but at the time it was more appropriately called the Lost Heads Recovery Ranch. And I went to my first AA meeting. I don't remember a thing that was said, not a single word. What I do know is I went back to my Uncle Paul's place afterwards and I wept. And I wept from just the deepest part of my gut. And let me tell you, there's a difference between that crying and the crying I used to do. I'm not a homicidal drunk. I'm the call you up in the middle of the night and tell you, do you know how much you mean to me? I don't know if you could possibly know how much I love you. Or the next night it could be, you ruined my life. You know, like, I'm that gross person. But this wasn't that kind of crying. It was like in the depth of my being. Because I felt, I think I knew then, without really knowing it, that this was the place that I belonged. And the thing is, we talk about our three legacies of recovery, unity, service, and recovery. And I'm telling you, for me, unity is so powerful. It's just like the fact that we are a physical presence here in this room tonight is ridiculously powerful. Even to me at this period of my sobriety, it still is powerful and such a strong demonstration of the power of the program that we have here. And I think for those of us that aren't able to sort of like articulate our feelings when we get here or really have a good concrete understanding of what's going on, just to feel the energy in the room and feel the love and feel the support spoke volumes to me. And I think I knew that this was for me. So I went to the program, and it was a 60-day residential program. And I did it the way a smart kid does school. I tried to get an A in rehab, and I was elected ward government. And, you know, I was like, well, it's not, you know, you can't really put that on your resume, but you're the ward president of the rehab. So I get back to L.A., and I start going to meetings. But I really didn't take it seriously. I was 20 years old, and I really can't attribute it to my age, because I have friends that got sober really super young, and they're solid, and they're still sober for a long time. I just really, I don't know. I just really wasn't willing to do what you guys told me to do. It's really that simple. I don't even want to overanalyze it, but like, I thought that I could kind of do my version of the program, which was sort of pick and take things and kind of manipulate it. The way. And you know, water seeks its own level. So I found those people in the program that were kind of doing things the way that I want to do it. So like I first found people that were doing non-addictive inhalants on the program. Like, you know, it's just an inhalant. You just sniff it and it only lasts 60 seconds. So it's like no big deal. Which then led me to doing, you know, non-addictive hallucinogenics again, because I'm spiritual and I'm trying to find the deep inner meaning within. So mind you, this whole time, I'm also telling myself, in the program, it talks about in the book about like self-knowledge is insufficient enough to keep us sober. So just knowing I'm an alcoholic isn't enough. I have to back it up with action. So I'm not doing anything, but at the same time, I'm like, well, sure, I'll take some of that ecstasy, but I drink alcohol? How dare you? You know, it's like, so I'm forcing myself away from liquor, but I'm doing all these other things. And when I was new, people used to talk about this thing. They used to refer to it as the marijuana maintenance program. Like you smoke weed so you don't drink. Well, I don't hear people talk about that anymore, but I did a different one. I did the crystal meth maintenance program. And not recommended as a plan of recovery. And I'm not going to say I did meth alcoholically. I did meth like a tweaker. But I'm telling you, the behavioral patterns were very similar. And the fact of the matter is I found something that for some reason, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks that the mind of an alcoholic lacks proportion and can't think straight. And the fact of the matter is that was my relationship to alcohol. I just couldn't wrap my head around any sort of responsible use of it whatsoever. And the same thing kind of happened when I started doing meth. I just like, same thing. I could not stop despite the circumstances. again, talking about like what I do for work right now and seeing people who like chronically experience these symptoms of psychosis. And that's part of their, it's part of what's going on with them. They can't escape it. The thing with me is I get paranoid. I think people are looking at me and chasing me, and I start hearing things in the trees and all that kind of stuff. But I stop and it goes away. Yet my mind cannot stop doing this thing. It keeps telling me, well, if you just do it again, maybe if you do a little bit more, it will go away, sometimes what my mind tells me. You know, I'm not a good big book quoter. I'm a fairly good big book paraphraser. But that's a part in the book that talks about we're unable to bring into sufficient force the memory of like the last horrible time we drank. And that was my experience with drinking. That was my experience with using meth. It's funny, we're driving up here. Last person I actively was really using a lot of meth with lived in Santa Ynez. And I will tell you, if you are, I'm not hoping none of you are considering using meth anytime in the near future, but if you live in the city and you're starting to hear things, you can kind of attribute to the traffic or people walking down the street. If you are in the middle of God's wonderland over here, and all there is wind blowing through the grass, your hallucinations and delusions feel all the more real. And so it just drove me over. So I get back to LA and I'm just not being able to manage it. And by this time, my aspirations at this point are nothing but being a mooch and a couch surfer. And I can't hold down a job, I can't go to school, I can't manage anything. At this point, nobody's letting me in the house. I am the lower companion. No one wants anything to do with me. And one more time, I just get into a place where I'm feeling physically bad, my heart starts being irregularities, and I go to an emergency room. Both times I've wound up in Alcoholics Anonymous have been prefaced with trips to the ER. Now, the first time, they did it to save my life. This time, I'm just paranoid and dehydrated, and everyone in the ER is just kind of going like, shaking their head. They put an IV tube in me, and they dehydrate me, and I don't know. They couldn't wait to get me off of that cot, you know, and get me out of there, because there were people obviously needed their services better than I did. So the truth of the matter is, why did I stay sober after March 30th, 1993, and not after November 20th, 1989? And in the big book, what's that line in the big book? I hate that. I just lost my mind here. I'll get to it. But anyway, it was just time, because I think it was just sort of like the external turmoil in my life matched the internal turmoil in my life to the extent that it was just completely unbearable. And I went to another meeting. I had one last couch I could sleep on. I had some friends that lived in Westwood over by UCLA, and they put up with me still. I had heard that down the street at the Ohio Street Clubhouse is where those Pacific Group people met. And from what we had heard from legend is that's where they sent all the bad people. That's not where they sent all the bad people. And like I said earlier in my talk, it was probably the best thing that could have happened to me, because that's where I got a good foundation of service and recovery. And while I was there, I had a sponsor for a while who was very rigorous in working the steps. And I actually, in my first few years of sobriety, got a very strong foundation in working the steps. And really kind of some magnificent stuff started happening. I know I kind of alluded to the whole idea of doing inventory and stuff a little bit before. I never wanted to look at my part, you know? That was the thing in my first sobriety. I remember my first sobriety when I first got here, I did like a 2-page typewritten inventory that had the name of the person I hated and the horrible thing they did to me, the end. I forgot the other two columns. And when I finally got down and when I did it the way it's outlined in the big book, I'm telling you, after I sat there and I read that thing, I felt like there was a DNA shift in my body, and I had a productive way of going back and making amends to people and trying to right the wrongs that I had done in other people's life. And I will tell you, not all my amends turned out picture perfect. None of them turned out particularly horrible, but none of them turned out really bad. And some of them, it's just sort of like the humble grace of the experience. You know, it also talks in the big book about, sitting down with somebody and making the formal amends and like years and years of like all of this horrible feeling just seemed to melt away. And sometimes that did happen. I remember I made amends to my mom. God, I put her to praises. I will tell you, I mean, even though I'm 51 years old right now, if one of the only things I got out of this is that my mom doesn't have to sit up at night worrying what her bizarre child is doing or where they're at or if they're dead, my family's overpaid just from that alone. But I sat down and I made amends to her. And what my sponsor at this particular point in my sobriety said was, when you go make amends, you ask them, what can I do to make it right? And he said that was very important for me to ask that question because that framed their response to something actionable, something that I could do. And he said, whatever came out of their mouths was going to be marching orders from God. And I was like, Mom, what can I do to make it right? And she says, I want you to be happy and healthy. She refused to take the money that I gave her. And I was like, I guess God's marching orders are for me to be happy and healthy. I've been fairly successful at that. I made amends to my stepfather. Put him through his paces. What can I do to make it right? Call your mom a lot. A friend who I thought I had burned every single bridge with, I made amends to him. What can I do to make it right? I've missed you. Call me more often. I was just, and you all know, they didn't all turn out this way. I'm giving you the good ones right now. But I think the thing is, like, I drank and I used for this sort of illusion to connect to something. And what happened instead was it made me more isolated. And the fact of the matter is, like, making these amends, I had no idea that this level of humanity was so existent in my life. And it was there the whole time. It's just my drinking and using obscured that. You know, we talk about the big book, it talks about that we suffer from 100 forms of fear. And I think that was the thing when I got here that was really difficult for me to think and conceptualize that I was ever going to become again somebody with any value. Even though I was only 24 years old, I really felt broken beyond repair. And the fact is, working these steps and doing the stuff we do around here has completely changed that. Completely changed that 100%. So I just keep doing what we're doing. If you're new and you're wondering, like, what's this weird thing that we're doing, I want to bring it back to that whole thing, because my barometer for my sobriety are those three legacies: unity, service, and recovery. And if you ask me what I've done to stay sober for, you know, almost 27 years, I've gone to meetings, I've worked the steps, and I've been of service. And it's looked at different ways at different times. Has it always been easy? No. Has it always been convenient? Absolutely not. Is it simple? Ridiculously simple. That's the thing, is it's not complicated. But this very uncomplicated thing that we do yields such amazing results. And it has in my life and the people that I sponsor through the years as well too. So the sponsor that was very rigorously taking me through the big book, he had this thing that we did, which we had me and all the other guys he sponsored look words up in the dictionary, which of course I loved because I'm a big bookworm and all that kind of stuff. So, but the point of it was not just look up the words that you don't know, but also look up the words that you know, but if someone pressed you to ask you for the dictionary definition, you go like, ugh. So like we're like power. Power's in the big book all the time. So what's power mean? Well, it's like the light switch, you turn on and the light blinks again, and it goes through the electric things, it's like, I couldn't define power like just like that. So doing things like that to try to understand the terminology we use around here. So he had me look up the word obsession. And I think that before that, I had this very dramatic idea of what the word obsession is. I'm going to really date myself. I've already dated myself, so I can't date myself any more than I already have. When I was younger, they used to have these Calvin Klein obsession ads for this perfume, this cologne. And they were like, it was very, this kind of like this thing, like this wanton lust was like, it was like, save me. This woman used to get up in there and say, so I always thought it was like this, like kind of like this lusty kind of like kind of thing. And the definition we came up with was that an obsession is an idea that outweighs all other ideas. I was like, wow. So what that means to me is that since March 30th, 1993, the idea of staying sober has outweighed the idea of getting loaded every day, one day at a time. as evidenced by the fact that I have not gotten loaded. Prior to March 30th, 1993, the idea of getting loaded outweighed all other ideas. Maintaining relationships with my friends and family, education, employment, personal hygiene. You know what I mean? So what that tells me is that if you're looking at a textbook definition like that, the obsession's been lifted. Because even if I've had a notion, it's been pushed to the side rather quickly in support of staying sober, which has been pretty much a delight the whole time. I remember that one of the words that he used before too, oh, I found out what that phrase from the big book was. It just finally came back to my mind. So why did I get sober this time? I love the sign of the big book. It says we were beaten to a state of reasonableness. Okay, good. I got that off my tail. Okay, so good. I can sleep tonight. But that's actually, because that's why I'm here. It was enough. It was enough at that time, and it was enough to get me through the door. Also, I wanted, before I tell this, I'm bouncing a little bit for the moment. I also want to say, I also know that I am grateful and lucky that I got a second window of opportunity to come back, because I've seen people cycle through the program over and over and over again, and sometimes they just don't make it. And I think that the number of people in my life that have OD'd is disproportionate to the average population, just by the sake of the types of things that we do. And it's difficult. I've had sponsees found dead in their apartments and stuff like that. So, but that kind of ties into what I was going to say anyway. So one of the definitions that the sponsor gave me at the time was of the word grace. And he said grace was an undeserved gift. I get what he was saying, but he's no longer with us, so I'm sorry, I'm going to challenge you. I believe that it is deserved. And I believe that the grace that's all bestowed upon every single one of us in this room is absolutely deserved. So on that note, I want to thank you all for listening. I want to thank you all for paying a 12-step call on me. It's been a delight to be up here, and thank you for listening.
Let's give another round of applause.